Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated March 14, 2014. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's top story, you're on the hook. Local governments in the Triangle are becoming increasingly more reliant on non-voter-approved debt. By Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. It used to be that when a North Carolina county or city wanted to build an expensive new jail, school, library, or water treatment plant, officials put it on a ballot and let the voters decide. But today, many of the state's larger cities and towns have stopped asking for voter approval and are spending the money anyway. It's all legal, as long as property taxes aren't being used to pay down the debt for those alternative financing methods, including the sale of limited obligation bonds or certificates of participation. But these non-voter-approved bonds still put the local government and its taxpayers on the hook for repayment if the project fails. Today, more than 40% of North Carolina's state debt is non-voter-approved debt. Here in the Triangle, about 45% of that $10 billion in bond debt owed by the Triangle's 13 counties and nearly 50 cities and towns is non-voter-approved debt, according to a review of data from the state treasurer's office. Building projects like the new Wake County Justice Center, a building that opened last summer in downtown Raleigh, the Durham County Courthouse that opened in 2012 in downtown Durham, and the Raleigh Convention Center complex were all paid for with bond funds that were never put on a ballot and never approved by the voters. The city of Raleigh is still paying down non-voter-approved bond debt dating back to 1996 for the construction of Walnut Creek Amphitheater. Sarah Curry, Director of Fiscal Policy Studies at the John Locke Foundation, a Raleigh-based conservative think tank, has been watching the ratio of non-voter-approved debt grow across the state, and she says it concerns her. The lack of transparency has allowed lawmakers to spend money on things that are not popular with the general population, she says. When general obligation bonds were passed, there were public campaigns to increase voter knowledge of the bond and the reason for the expenditure. Now lawmakers can issue these non-voter-approved forms of debt without the input of the public, thus making it easier for lawmakers to spend money on more special interest projects than before, Curry says. Many voters would not approve some of the debt that was passed, and it had it been put to a vote. Local government leaders defend the practice of using limited obligation bonds because they say it's quicker than waiting for the next election cycle to put a bond referendum on the ballot. And when interest rates are low, it can be cheaper to issue the debt now versus later. Sometimes you don't have a choice in spending the money, even if the voter says no, says Joe Durham, interim Wake County manager. Look at 1999 when the bond referendum for schools failed. You've still got to build schools when you have so many new students moving into the county. What if the voter says no to building a jail when it's needed? Sometimes you don't have a choice in the matter. Non-voter-approved bonds typically carry a higher interest rate because they are not backed by the government's taxing authority and are instead secured by the building or asset it is paying for. In other words, a government can't raise taxes to pay down the principal or interest on a limited obligation bond, but it can raise fees and other sources of income to avoid default. Bond attorney Tim Lee of Womble Carlisle Law Firm in Raleigh says that many government groups have chosen the limited obligation bond route in recent years because the interest rates have been so low that it's evened the playing field. It's not free money, but it's close, he says. If it's a project you know you're going to need, this is a great time to do it. By state law, no municipality, county, or authority may incur more than 8% of the appraised value of its taxable property in debt. As of June 2012, no county or municipality in North Carolina was even close to that threshold. On average, North Carolina counties carry debt equal to about 1.3% of appraised property value. The state's cities and towns have an average of 0.7% debt ratio, according to the state treasurer's report. North Carolina also has some of the strictest rules in the country when it comes to local governments borrowing money to pay for capital projects. For one, debt can only be issued for specific new building, equipment, or capital asset projects, not for operation expenses. Lee argues that North Carolina's debt obligations could never be compared to the $17 trillion public debt obligations that the federal government is facing. The federal government borrows to balance its budget. We don't do that in North Carolina, he says. It has to be for a capital project. Also, the state's local government commission under the state treasurer's office must first approve almost all local government debt, and the local government commission arranged the sale of almost all local bonds in the state. That oversight has been credited with helping North Carolina retain its AAA credit rating for many years, and that debt oversight has trickled down to AAA credit ratings for many of the state's other large county and city governments, including Wake County, Durham County, Raleigh, Durham, and Cary. George Quick, chief financial officer of Durham County, says that sometimes gambling on a project that even voters have disapproved of can pay off in the long run, such as when the Durham City Council in 1995 boldly approved a referendum to build the Durham Bulls Athletic Park after voters had rejected a similar plan 5 years earlier. The DBAP is now the centerpiece of the revitalized American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham that has attracted hundreds of new jobs for the city and contributed millions of dollars in new investment capital. Granted, the public couldn't see all that growth that would happen down the road, but the leadership back then saw it, Quick says, and now we can all see the results. Still on the front page, bankruptcy and sale swirl around Anthony's World, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. While Raleigh real estate investor Jim Anthony is working through a reorganization plan for his troubled Burlington Outlet Village shopping center in Burlington, he can at least remove one other problem site from his plate. In recent days, Anthony finalized the $4.2 million sale of a large shopping mall he's owned since 2003 near Niagara Falls, New York, that has been going through its own troubles. Anthony had been a major investor in the 800,000-square-foot Summit Park Mall through the entity Oberlin Plaza One LLC since 2003 when he inherited the property as part of a foreclosure proceeding. But even after renovations, the property was forced into bankruptcy protection in 2009 and most of its retail stores were shuttered. The bulk of the mall is empty and has been gutted by vandals, according to Buffalo News reports. Anthony says he's determined not to let the same thing happen at Burlington Outlet Village, a 250,000-square-foot shopping center off Interstate 40 I-85 that he and a group of family investors bought in 2006. Anthony, who also serves as the Raleigh CEO of the global real estate brokerage firm Colliers International, says that when they bought the property, it was generating $1.2 million in annual net operating income. "We thought we could improve on that," he says. But a year later, the real estate markets collapsed nationally, resulting in the closure of several of Burlington Outlet Village's stores. About a year after that, Tanger Outlet Center announced plans to build a new outlet mall about 10 miles away in Mebane. "That was kind of a death knell because our Tanger-type tenants all moved over there," he says. The retail center hit bottom in 2012 when the property generated only about $200,000 in rental income. Since that time, Anthony says they've been working to attract more local mom-and-pop-style tenants, including local nonprofit agencies, fitness centers, churches, thrift shops, and discount furniture stores. The center is currently about 70% occupied. But according to court documents in Alamance County, Anthony's investment entity, BMOC Investors LLC, defaulted on an $8.3 million loan with Wells Fargo Bank in 2009, and a foreclosure auction is scheduled for March 20. Anthony said this week that the debt balance is now around $5.8 million and that he will likely very soon be filing a Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection on behalf of the LLC that owns the Burlington property. "I've turned it over to my attorney," he says. "We're trying to do the right thing." Continuing on the front page, NCMA hires firm for a new park plan. This article is also by Amanda Jones Hoyle, and it's from Raleigh. The 164-acre park that surrounds the North Carolina Museum of Art is already an evolving landscape for local artists, but museum leaders think more can be done with the property. The museum has commissioned Civitas Incorporated, an international urban design firm based in Denver, to develop a new vision plan for the museum's park on Blue Ridge Road in Raleigh. The vision plan, says Civitas founding principal Mark Johnson, would present actionable ideas that could be implemented in the park as funds become available in the future. The plan is expected to be presented to the museum in July with the idea that funds would be raised for its initial phase of development soon thereafter. NCMA understands that the museum can broaden its mission to become an agent of education and change to a much broader community than just the normative museum members, says Johnson. So identifying who these audiences might be and what kind of programs might attract and retain them is part of our assignment. For Dan Gottlieb, the Director of Planning and Design for Museum, the vision plan is more than just an update. This is going to be a 7-month process that stretches from idea sharing to concept development, Gottlieb says, and with the Blue Ridge Corridor talks underway, it presents us with a unique opportunity. Gottlieb did not discuss how much money is being paid to Civitas for the project, but said the firm was hired by the Museum Foundation's board. The implementation of bold new ideas costs money, and the art museum, headed by the effervescent Larry Wheeler, most likely will have to rally his troops to raise additional money in the future. Wheeler's team is just about to close on a $50 million capital campaign that started in 2010 and was scheduled to close last December. Art museum proponents have long wanted more support from the state government, which appropriates about $7 million on an annual basis. But that covers very little of the program expenses for the museum, officials say. Most of the state appropriations go towards salaries of personnel to keep the museum running for visitors. Museum officials reiterate that the vision plan is not a master plan. As Gottlieb noted, the museum updates its master plan periodically, with the last update occurring in 2008. Civitas is a landscape architecture firm that has also done work with local governments and corporate investors across the country, including the National Museum of Wildlife Art in Wyoming. It is not affiliated with the Civitas Institute think tank in Raleigh. This week in Amanda Hoyle's column that covers commercial and residential real estate, she writes about Cary's Publix and Bradford taking shape. The $80 million project has the region's largest apartment complex. Construction of the Triangle's first Publix grocery store has begun as workers started pouring the concrete footings for the foundation of the store at Bradford in Cary. Publix will be anchoring the retail side of Bradford, an $80 million mixed-use development project of Charlotte-based Northwood Raven, located at the crossroads of Davis Drive and High House Road. The other crown jewel of Bradford, its 390-unit high-end apartment community, will begin moving in its first tenants on March 22nd. It is currently the largest apartment community under construction in the region. Northwood Raven's Development Director of Raleigh Operations, Jeff Furman, has been working on the plans for Bradford for more than 6 years and says the apartments have been designed to specifications of a condominium building with elevator access, enclosed hallways, electronic key lock entry, and lots of detailed extras in the units. The units that are in the highest demand are actually the big units, he says. We've seen growth happening all across the demographics. You used to assume it was the young professionals who were your customers, but there are a lot of folks who are moving here from other places who maybe haven't sold their house yet, or they had to sell their house at a loss. High-end rental allows someone who lived in a nice house to not sacrifice what they had before, Furman says. In addition to the Publix, Bradford will have another 16,600 square feet of small shop space and 6 retail out parcels. The Hand and Stone Massage and Facial Spa has signed a lease for one of the shop spaces and a T-Mac sports grill will be opening one of the corner out parcels. The T-Mac building will break ground on April 15th. The entire project will be finished in late fall of 2014. Looking for U.S. Open lodging? Rent a house. If you're looking for something a little roomier than a hotel room for either or both, the U.S. Men's and Women's Open Championships happening in Pinehurst this summer, why not rent a private home in the area instead? To make it easier for U.S. Open spectators who might be in the market for a rental home, the Pinehurst Southern Pines Area Association of Realtors has partnered with the Area Convention and Visitors Bureau to create a multiple listing service style website for U.S. Open rental homes. Most of the homes are advertising prices of $20,000 for 2 weeks of Major League Golf. For $100,000, you can rent for both U.S. Open Golf Weeks a 5-bedroom home with a swimming pool about 5 miles from Pinehurst Resort. Or for the $1,300, you can rent a 1-bedroom house in Carthage for each week. Next up, North Carolina experts to help launch state's new contractors college. 5 of North Carolina's largest construction firms are teaming up with the state's Office for Small and Historically Underutilized Businesses to help minority businesses win more work on state and local government construction jobs. The Hub Office recently launched its inaugural NC Contractors College, a 12-week program for certified hub construction contractors on the campus of NC Central University in Durham, says Dennis English, director of the state hub office. Sponsors and teachers of the program will be coming from Turner Construction, Skanska USA, Lindley's, Balfour Beatty, and SRS Construction Incorporated. This week in Jason DeBruin's column, he covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. He has an article here entitled, Clinipace Expands Its Asian Footprint, and Recent Acquisition Heralds Growth in Emerging Markets. Morrisville Contract Research Organization Clinipace Worldwide acquired Choice Pharma, a pan-Asian CRO that gives Clinipace a stronger presence in the Eastern world. Financial details of the deal were not announced, although Clinipace reported with the federal regulators on March 10th that it raised $2.6 million in a private placement. With the merger, the company extends its global footprint to include 20 operational offices in 15 countries, including new offices in Taiwan, China, Hong Kong, South Korea, Vietnam, Singapore, and Malaysia. With the addition of 120 employees from Choice, Clinipace now has 640 on its global staff. The combined company has managed more than 1,500 clinical research studies and 300 completed regulatory and strategic development engagements. Jeff Williams, Clinipace CEO, says he receives acquisition or merger offers from other research companies on a nearly weekly basis. That's what happens when a fast-growing company successfully completes 4 mergers in just a few years. More often than not, something that doesn't fit well, and Williams kindly rejects the offer. When it came to Choice Pharma, however, things just clicked. The timing was perfect, Williams said. In some respects, Choice actually grew too successfully for its own good. Owned by a London-based investment group, Choice clients wanted it to grow to be able to perform in the Western world, but that wasn't something the owners were interested in pursuing on their own. At the same time, Williams wanted Clinipace, which had grown to about 520 employees, to establish a stronger presence in the emerging markets in Asia. The marriage of the two companies accomplishes both their goals. Drug development companies must test their new therapeutics in patients to compile an application package that outlines the benefits and risk of a new drug. They then submit to government agencies throughout the world, including the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Governments must approve a drug before a pharma company may market that product in the respective countries. As a contract research company, Clinipace outperforms many of those drug trials for pharmaceutical companies. Governments in Asian countries often want a drug tested in their country with their population before approving a drug in their country, so in order to put together a strong application package to sell a new drug in those countries, pharmaceutical companies want data from trials in those countries. Therefore, Clinipace has long wanted a stronger presence in Asia so it can offer drug development companies trials in those countries. For us, it was about the emerging markets, Williams said. Nearly every drug developer is thinking about how to penetrate those emerging markets. If you ever intend to market your drug in an area, you have to have done some research in that area. William credits governments for taking this stance. Not only does it provide an added layer of protection from potential side effects of the new drugs, it also spurs economic activity in their countries. The fact of the matter is, it's pretty smart of those governments, he says. By the numbers, Quintiles insiders announced this week they would look to sell off chunks of their stock holdings in a new offering. Because this stock offering is from individuals or investment groups, Quintiles will not receive any money. Instead, profits from any stock sold will go directly to the seller. Here's how some insiders could make out. 15 million. That's the total shares that will be offered. $54.46. That is the price per share in the offering. $940 million. Total value of all the shares being offered. $207 million. Amount Quintiles founder Dennis Gillings would be in line to receive. He is offering 3.8 million of his own shares. Also, Inc. Research also is in expansion mode, with Lebanon Buy. Raleigh's Inc. Research expanded into the Middle East with the acquisition of MEK Consulting, a CRO based in Lebanon. The acquisition positions in Inc. in the Middle East and North Africa regions where it has more than 200 million patients. The acquisition means similar things to Inc. as the Clinipace deal with Choice means that for a research company and is just another sign that these pharmaceutical research organizations are increasingly looking to grow their international footprints. And this week's column by Lauren Onisorge covers technology and entrepreneurship. And her Startup Spotlight column says, "Say hello to my little virtual friend. Durham Company's hologram technology could have broader applications." Meet Angeline. She's polite. She's a polite Caucasian female in her early 20s, and she's a complete work of fiction. Angeline is a virtual presenter, an animation on a digital silhouette, motion-activated so that she'll chat you up at the exact moment you pass by, but everything from her smirk to her darting eyes is programmed. She's the brainchild of a pair of entrepreneurs, David Rose and Chuck Rinker, intended to catch your eye at an event, but her creators hope she'll have several careers in everything from retail to security. Angeline, one of a dozen mannequins with hologram heads, is a product of the new company's personas. While there are other digital presenters out there, the typical method is to have an actor with a script and projecting him or her on the digital silhouette. It's really not a scalable solution because when we do this for brands, that means a whole new video shoot, Rose explains. But by creating something new and programmable, not only can you upload new content for a new client, but you also aren't limited to just Angeline. Past presenters have included Albert Einstein and even dinosaurs. It would be hard to get a dinosaur into a studio, Rose laughs. The digital silhouettes have motion sensors, evidenced by the dinosaurs on the display at the North Carolina Zoo. When you trip the motion sensor, it lets out a ferocious growl, he says. There's also credit card capability. Imagine being able to swipe your credit card and purchase products from the presenter. No human required. The pair sees multiple applications, including a TSA agent that could keep watch for security threats and a patient discharge person at a hospital. The presenter even collects data from event attendees so companies can know exactly how many people she's engaging with. Rinker and Rose are also working on facial tracking technology so that her periodic eye movements can become more focused. It's all about enhancing reality, but it comes at a cost. Currently, the mannequins are being rented for an upfront fee of $18,500 and $250 a month for analytics and upkeep. But that's now. What we're thinking it's going to really get interesting is when we ramp up volume, Rinker says. If we produce 50, the cost to manufacture comes down like 40%. But that ramp-up requires initial funds. Thus far, Rinker and Rose have been able to fund the company themselves, as all the research and development has already been paid for at New Media. We did six figures of revenue last year and turned a profit, Rose says. The question is whether they'll let go of some of that equity to accept institutional help. Personas is based at the American Underground's Main Street Durham hub. Also this week, in Lauren Onisorge's column on technology and entrepreneurship, Durham's Windsor Circle lures a mystery investor. Big things are happening at Durham marketing software firm Windsor Circle, including an investment by a publicly traded software firm. While CEO Matt Williamson can't name the firm, he does say the deal, between $5 million and $7 million, will close in the second quarter. The mystery company isn't the only publicly traded software firm zeroing in on Windsor Circle. The 15-person operation has snagged an invitation to Google for Entrepreneurs Demo Day in Mountain View, California, on April 2nd. It and another Durham startup, Automated Insights, are the only North Carolina teams competing in the pitch competition, which will put 10 startups in front of more than 100 Silicon Valley investors. We've had a lot of national-level firms tracking us for quite a while, he says, people who saw us 2 years ago when we had 20 customers and barely scratched the surface have now seen us execute. He points to customers such as NPR, Under Armour, and Billabong. They're all validation points that didn't exist 2 years ago. The company has raised more than $3 million in institutional investment. Also, Mark Buff, founder of Raleigh-based Mohu, an 80-person company that already sells its Leaf antenna line at big box stores. Mohu is in the middle of an oversubscribed Kickstarter round to fund Mohu Channels, a technology that puts streaming content on the same menu as over-the-air channels, allowing users to cut the cable cord and still watch their favorite shows. We believe Mohu Channels is a cord-cutter stream machine, and this new device and approach stands to change the way everyone views free over-the-air HD TV content forever. This week's column from Dawn Curry covers small business personalities and triangle trends. And she writes how the beer industry is packing a punch in North Carolina, the popularity of craft brews reflected in the growth statistics. A statistical breakdown of North Carolina beer industry shows the economic impact that brewers, distributors, and retailers have on the state. In 2012, the beer industry contributed $2.9 billion to North Carolina's economy, and 37,260 jobs generated $949 million in wages. In 2012, the state had 82 active brewery permits, and compared that to 63 in 2011. According to a study conducted by the Beer Institute in partnership with the National Beer Wholesalers Association, North Carolina had 71 brewing establishments, 94 distributors, and 18,331 retailers dedicated to beer as of 2012. These generated $109 million in federal excise taxes, $117 million in state excise taxes, and $124 million in other local taxes. In the Triangle, the beer industry contributed 4,697 jobs, paying $160 million in wages. Of those jobs, 286 were business and personal service jobs, 157 were financial insurance and real estate jobs, 109 were transportation and communications-related jobs, 85 were agricultural, and 54 were wholesale jobs. Those numbers slightly outpace those of Asheville's, the area to which the Triangle's craft brewery scene is often compared. The Asheville area has 3,947 jobs supporting the beer industry in 2012, for which $146 million in wages were paid. Of those jobs, 231 were business and personal service jobs, 87 were finance, insurance, and real estate jobs, 101 were transportation and communication related, 41 were agricultural, and 44 were wholesale jobs. According to the National Brewers Association, 2013 growth numbers will be released later this month. Rainbow Crosswalks in Raleigh, We'll see. Raleigh's downtown warehouse district could see a colorful makeover. On April 2nd, the City of Raleigh will host a downtown plan visioning session to assess how creative urbanism can be infused into the area over the course of 10 years. The City of Raleigh and the Downtown Raleigh Alliance is hoping to start a public conversation about the possibility of painted crosswalks such as those in the Castro District of San Francisco. According to Raleigh Chief Planning and Development Officer Mitchell Silver, the crosswalks won't necessarily be rainbows such as those in San Francisco, but could be a variety of painted styles. Public safety meets public art, says Silver in a tweet last Friday, also mentioning that the painted crosswalks could go other places around the city. And the Umstead Spa ranks among the world's best. The Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary has been named to Town & Country's list of the 14 most transformational wellness destinations around the world. The list, according to the magazine, includes mind-blowing spa experiences that fulfill New Year's goals and put a premium on relaxation and rejuvenation. To that end, Town & Country cites the nearby William B. Umstead State Park and the retreat's private pools as amenities that help create a vacation experience. The Umstead Spa offers organic treatments, body mask, massage therapy, facials, manicures, pedicures, as well as a steam sauna and whirlpool. Next up, hot IPO market mobilizes firms to test waters, by Sugata Mukherjee from Durham. The most recent initial public offering, note, from Renaissance Capital, a research group that tracks public markets, was nothing short of staggering. Renaissance reports that runs through the end of February may explain why there are so many local companies such as Square One Bank and Synexis waiting to go out, while others such as Argos Therapeutics, Nifrin Genetics, Channel Advisor, and Plygem seized the market opportunity and started trading publicly in recent months. Durham's Quintiles is not mentioned in the group because the contract research organizational fiscal parameters are far different from any other IPOs in the Triangle in recent years. For starters, they have $4 billion in sales. In 2014, there were 55 IPO filings through February, up 162% from the same time in 2013. Already, 37 companies have gone public through February, up to 20 last year, and collectively, these companies have raised about $7 billion, up from $5.5 billion last year. These numbers reflect a bullish pattern. For Triangle entrepreneurs, lawyers, and accountants, these are the good times. For local venture capital firms looking for an exit, this means content general partners and hopeful entrepreneurs looking for cash. So far, there is little doubt that biotechnology is the hottest sector for Wall Street bankers to market the shares. More than 55% of the IPOs to date are from healthcare companies, including biotech. But as Renaissance Capital points out, recent filings suggest the technology sector is getting hot. There may have just been only three tech companies that went public this year, but scores of them are waiting on the sidelines with several deals imminent. The IPO market is becoming frothy, says Larry Robbins, a Raleigh lawyer who is working with several companies exploring public markets. You wonder how long the IPO market will remain this hot. A question that perhaps would be easier to answer by the end of the year. As Robin pointed out, there are many companies in the Triangle that could use the public money to accelerate development, and that means jobs for our economy and the potential of having a home run company in our backyard, he says. This week's executive voice is Jesse Lipson. He's also known as a magic man with a business plan. And Citrix, Jesse Lipson shares his dreams, roadblocks, and visions for entrepreneurship with Lauren Oney Sarge this week. When ShareFile founder Jesse Lipson first announced that he'd be selling his company to Florida tech giant Citrix in 2011, it had 85 employees. Today it has 450, 425 of which are in Raleigh. This summer, his team will move into a space in downtown Raleigh that was the old Dillon Supply warehouse, thanks to Citrix's $12.5 million investment in the local team. It's part of the downtown Raleigh's rebirth as a tech mecca spurred by tech giant Red Hat's move downtown last year. But Citrix, a software company developing and selling work-from-home applications, is just part of Lipson's story. Lipson was one of the founding backers in both HQ Raleigh and ThinkHouse, two startup movements aiming to give Raleigh a lasting legacy as an entrepreneurship hub. TBJ questioned Mr. Lipson, and he answers. TBJ, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? Mr. Lipson, when I was in middle school and at the beginning of high school, I wanted to be a professional magician. I even invented and sold a couple of magic tricks. TBJ, what's your most memorable business moment? Mr. Lipson, a couple of weeks after ShareFile was acquired by Citrix, I did a live demo of ShareFile at the keynote for Synergy Barcelona for 4,000 people. That moment really made me understand how ShareFile now had the opportunity to play on a much bigger stage, literally and figuratively, than before. TBJ, where do you see the Triangle's entrepreneurship community in 10 years? What's the biggest challenge for entrepreneurs here? Mr. Lipson, I see a lot of momentum in Raleigh-Durham with organizations like HQ Raleigh, American Underground, and Triangle Startup Factory. I hope over the next 10 years the community will continue to grow rapidly and will be able to find our unique voice to differentiate us from the entrepreneurs in other areas. I think the biggest challenge of the entrepreneurship in the Triangle is living in the shadow of Silicon Valley. This is changing, though. Startups are becoming more decentralized as technology makes physical location less important. TBJ, what's the biggest roadblock you faced in business and how did you overcome it? Mr. Lipson, it was my first company. My other three partners and I set up the corporate structure in a very inefficient way. Eventually, the need for unanimous consent on almost every decision and the lack of incentive for individual performance put us in a holding pattern where we had a lot of opportunities but could not capitalize on them. Ultimately, we went our separate ways and pursued the parts of business that we were passionate about. TBJ, what's something about you that might surprise our readers? Mr. Lipson, some people may be surprised that I was not trained in computer science but instead majored in philosophy. My original plan was to become a philosophy professor, but I caught the dot-com bug shortly before graduation and decided to learn computer programming while at my first job. TBJ, what's a typical day off like for you? Mr. Lipson, on weekends I usually spend a few hours each day catching up on email and other work tasks. Aside from that, my wife and I like to take long walks in Raleigh, drink wine, and watch our favorite TV shows. The latest is House of Cards. I also like to watch college basketball and have Duke season tickets. TBJ, where's your favorite vacation spot? Mr. Lipson, my favorite vacation spot is a small island in eastern Caribbean. It has no cars and only about 100 houses. When I land there, I delete my work email account from my phone, iPad, and laptop, and I don't set them up again until I get to the airport. TBJ, what's your favorite movie? Mr. Lipson, The Big Lebowski. TBJ, what apps are on your phone right now? Mr. Lipson answers, I have lots of apps, but the ones I use the most are ShareFile, Uber, GoGo, which is airplane Wi-Fi, Delta, Rhapsody, TripIt, Facebook, and Twitter. TBJ, what's the scariest thing you've ever done? Mr. Lipson answers, I am not much of a daredevil, but snorkeling with whale sharks in Mexico was kind of scary. Still continuing with the interview format, we have five questions with Joel Ray. Mr. Ray is the chief nursing officer at Rex Healthcare. The Triangle Business Journal asks, what is the best piece of business advice you have ever received? And Mr. Ray answers, United States Air Force Major General, retired Melissa Rank, former chief of the Air Force Nurse Corps, told me to never forget that nursing is a clinical discipline, and most importantly, how to keep the patient and family at the center of everything we do. TBJ, what accomplishments are you most proud of from the past year? Mr. Ray, From 2008 through 2013, while at UNC Hospitals, I had the privilege of being very involved and worked to provide the best experience possible for our patients. UNC Hospitals was number one in patient-centeredness among its peer academic healthcare organizations in the University Healthcare Consortium. Of course, it is an accomplishment achieved by the hard work and dedication of all the co-workers, but keeping the patient at the center of everything we do in today's complex healthcare environment is something to celebrate. On a more personal level, I am very proud to recently be selected as a Chief Nursing Officer and Vice President of Patient Care Services at Rex Healthcare. I have been given an extraordinary opportunity to join the executive team at one of the top community hospitals in our country. TBJ asks, what are some of the top of mind goals that you are looking to achieve in the next year? Mr. Ray answers, our mission at Rex Healthcare is to provide the best in health services by bringing together compassionate care and leading-edge technology. On June 20th, we go live with our new electronic medical record, EPIC, at UNC. This technology represents an enormous step forward in our ability to create one patient ID, one problem list, one medication list, and one bill for each patient across all UNC healthcare locations. TBJ asks, what is the most important role of a nurse? And Mr. Ray answers, a nurse needs to be a patient advocate. Healthcare is complex and involves many disciplines. TBJ asks Mr. Ray, what keeps you up at night? And Mr. Ray answers, while we know that no hospital or healthcare system has achieved perfection throughout their organization, it must be our goal. As a CNO and healthcare executive, I must be preoccupied with risks. What is the next new threat to patient safety? How do we drive hospital-acquired infections and injuries to zero? This week's column on family business by James Lee, an attorney, addresses generation gaps in the family business. Question. There's a problem. My father and his brother have run a menswear store in our town for nearly 30 years. I've worked in the store for about half that time, and now I'm ready for them to retire and let me take over the whole operation. The change is overdue. The old guys have slowed down, they fuss at the employees and one another in front of customers, and their fashion sense is 10 years out of date. How do I get these two guys out of the store? Mr. Lee answers, there's a problem out here, all right, and you're it. Whenever I hear a younger member of a family business say of the senior generation, I'm ready for them to retire, I duck behind the furniture. The next stage in that family's relationships will either be a slow corrosive burn or open warfare. The timing of management and leadership transition in a family business is a crucial factor. Although being deliberate and sensitive can be frustrating and even risky, it's even riskier to run through a succession process like a water buffalo through a tea party. Things may be in better shape than your question indicates. If not, approach your father and uncle with an action plan, focusing on improving and sustaining the business, not moving them out of the store. Making the case that you're capable of leading the business into the next generation and giving them a chance to take on new roles other than daily management. They might just be waiting for an invitation. Question. Every time I suggest a change in the way my father runs our lumber company, he says it won't work. I say get rid of my two cousins who are just pretending to be salesmen. Dad says no, because this is a family business. I say hire a consultant to get our management systems up to speed. Dad says we'll run the way we've always have because this is a family business. It's driving me crazy. Do you have any ideas? Mr. Lee answers, it's common for members of families in business to disagree on whether the family should support the business or the business support the family, or both. Some families believe strongly that their business's primary function is to finance the family's lifestyle. Others believe the business's health and continuity depends on the family deferring its non-business wants. I tend toward the preserve the business end of the poll. If family employees aren't doing their fair share of the work of the company, they shouldn't be kept on the job just because they're related. On the other hand, a family business usually blends family values with business imperatives, so there might be a room to cut an underperformer a little slack. Try to make small improvements when you can and wait until you are better able to influence influence company policy. Maybe by that time, your viewer, the tie between the family and the business will have changed. This week's People Spotlight is on Nicole Blake, Director of Human Resources at Longistics. Armed with years of experience in the human resources industry, Nicole Blake has been named Director of Human Resources at Longistics, a Raleigh-based logistics provider. In her role, she oversees many duties involving personnel at Longistics. Among them are recruitment and selection, compensation and benefits, employee relations, performance management, and training and development. She manages the company's human resources information system, HIRIS, and works to ensure that the company's policies and procedures comply with state and federal guidelines. Blake is also charged with implementing culture-related events and change management principles that are designed to increase employee morale and improve productivity overall at Longistics. Longistics was founded by Dwayne Long and his wife Pat 30 years ago. TBJ asks the question, "What's one thing you wish people knew about your job?" Ms. Blake answers, "It's exciting, challenging, and a privilege to work with the talented group of people we have here at Longistics." Ms. Blake was born and raised in Hampton, Virginia, but she lived in Charleston, South Carolina, and she's a Navy brat. Her father was in the submarine force for more than 24 years. TBJ asks, "What are your goals for this position?" Ms. Blake answers, "I am interested in recruiting and retaining the most qualified and experienced over-the-road team drivers as possible. I'm also excited to move the company forward technologically through the use of our online HRIS portal, which will house training videos, employee resources, and etc. Developing an effective wellness program for all employees is also a major goal." TBJ asks, "What is your biggest pet peeve?" And Ms. Blake replies, "People who lack excitement for what they do. Life is too short to be miserable and to make the people around you miserable. Find something you enjoy doing and be passionate about it. I am passionate about making a difference in people's lives. Sometimes that means finding them employment, and other times it's as simple as showing someone that you care about them and their development professionally." TBJ asks, "What is your biggest worry?" "I worry that there will not be enough people of my generation who will know or who will go into the transportation field. Truck drivers are in serious demand throughout the country. I wish more people knew about the good living you can have financially and professionally by becoming involved in the transportation field." TBJ asks, "What is the Triangle area business person you most admire?" And Ms. Blake replies, "I have had the chance to work with many inspiring people, but one that stands out would be Charles L. Faust, Jr., Chief Operating Officer with Wake Health Services. Serving an underserved population for their health care needs is not an easy task, especially in this day and age, but Charles does it with class and dignity." Ms. Blake received her Human Resource Management degree from Peace College, now William Peace University, and she's been married to her husband John going on 12 years. And she has a 4-year-old son, Caleb, and a 2-year-old daughter named Kaylee. This week's editor's notebook is from Sugata Mukherjee. Mr. Mukherjee is the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. His column this week is entitled, "Leveraging Our College Rankings." "I read with interest the U.S. News and World Report's latest rankings of our local universities and colleges. Colleges that offer graduate degrees. This online news magazine, its last print issue was published in December 2010, has been very popular with these rankings for colleges that choose to participate in the survey, while others who choose not to take part in this exercise feel the rankings are biased and unscientific. The skeptics that claim the study compares colleges that may be similar in size but vastly different in mission and culture. They argue U.S. News puts too much value on reputation, alumni giving, and low rate of acceptance when they should be focused on graduation and job placements. Okay, maybe there is a point. But when one considers just how many publications, news websites, television stations, newswires, and college newspapers reported the latest rankings of graduate schools, perception has become the reality. On March 11, when the rankings were released, more than 200 different articles appeared just 4 hours after the press release. This is free publicity for colleges who are constantly touting the good rankings, with some of them going on an advertising blitz following the rankings release. One thing, however, is very noticeable. Blue-chip schools such as Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Columbia, and Penn are always in the top tier, year after year. Seldom do those change. Rankings follow the top schools gyrate considerably, especially if these colleges are ranked below number 50. As for Duke and UNC, most of their schools are ranked in the top 20, with Duke doing better in business and law, and UNC doing better in medicine. NC State always ranks high in engineering and vet school listings. The U.S. News Report may not be the most comprehensive study of a higher education, but do not be surprised if you have university administrators from UNC, NCSU, ECU, and a few other colleges bringing up the rankings when talking about state appropriations with Governor Pat McCrory and State Budget Director Art Pope. McCrory touts the jobs and economics development rankings for the North Carolina and shoots off press releases to the media whenever possible. Why shouldn't UNC President Tom Ross do the same on behalf of UNC schools when asking for money from legislatures? In the end, these rankings matter. Next up is this week's guest opinion, is by Andrew Broad. Mr. Broad is a senior research fellow at UNCG Center for Business and Economic Research. His column is entitled, Minimum Wage Debate Can't Be Resolved Without Winners and Losers. Arguing about the minimum wage never goes out of style. The Obama administration has proposed to raise the federal minimum wage from the current $7.25 per hour to $10.10, and once again the political battle lines are drawn. Be outside of politics, there is a growing convergence of opinion on the minimum wage. Opinion polls show that a solid majority of Americans favor an increase. Even a slim majority of rank-and-file Republicans favor it. And then there are the economists. For decades, conservatives could count on the economists to back up their opposition to minimum wage increases. In 1976, Nobel laureate George Stigler says it's not possible to enlist good economists to defend minimum wage laws. In 1990, 82% of the members of the American Economic Association agreed or agreed with conditions with the statement, quote, a minimum wage increases unemployment among young and unskilled workers, end quote. But in the 1990s, new research began to show that a rising minimum wage does not always lead to job losses. As a result, the consensus among economists has shifted during the last 20 years. Many economists still believe that the minimum wage costs jobs, but a growing majority think the benefits outweigh the cost. This view was a factor in a recent study by the Congressional Budget Office, which projected the likely outcome of increases in the minimum wage to $9 and $10.10. The CBO did this by summarizing the existing research on minimum wages. The headlines focused on one particular conclusion of the study, that an increase to $10.10 would lead to 500,000 jobs lost. But there was more. That projection was actually the midpoint of an interval that ran from nearly zero up to almost 1 million. In other words, the CBO's projection was a job loss of 500,000 plus or minus 500,000. That's a big margin of error, but it reflects economists' uncertainty on this point. Moreover, the CBO report assigned a 33% probability that job losses would be outside of that wide interval. That implies a 1 in 3 chance that job losses would either be greater than 1 million or less than zero, which would mean job gains. According to the CBO, our best guess is that there will be 500,000 lost jobs if the minimum wage is increased to $10.10, but it's a guess with lots of finger crossing. In contrast, there is much less uncertainty in the CBO report regarding the benefits of an increase to $10.10. The report projects that $16.5 million workers would get a raise and 900,000 workers would be lifted out of poverty. Those are big numbers when compared to job losses. Clearly, there would be winners and losers from raising the minimum wage, but that's true of all economic policies. Consider the example of free trade agreements. Not everyone wins. Economists generally support freer trade because the winners, usually consumers, gain more than the losers, usually a subset of workers. Is it a problem for 500,000 people, give or take, to lose their jobs if the minimum wage were raised? Of course it is. But to economists, the only rational way to assess a policy is by weighing the benefits of as well as the cost. Based on the CBO report, the benefit-cost ratio of an increase to $10.10 looks pretty good. It shouldn't be crazy to claim that 500,000 lost jobs is too high a cost to bear, but that's an opinion that fewer and fewer economists agree with. 1 bit, 2 bits, 3 bits a profit. If everyone used Bitcoin at Durham's Rise Biscuits and Donuts, owner Tom Ferguson says he'd save $220,000 a year. That would take care of the raises, raise the minimum wage. It would also let me do a week's vacation for everybody at my company, he says. Why? Because he wouldn't have to pay credit card fees to banks. Why should a company working on a 12% margin on my business give away 3% or 2.7% to the bank just to collect money for me, he asked. Ferguson doesn't hide his passion for Bitcoin. If it works, it's really going to solve some of the issues we have. Chris Powers and Les Stewart, co-owners of the Trophy Brewing Company of Raleigh, attended the craft beer VIP event held at Natty Green's Brew Pub in downtown Raleigh on Tuesday. 17 other breweries also attended, including Noda Brewery of Charlotte and Front Street Brewery of Wilmington. The event was hosted by the North Carolina Craft Brewers Guild. Trophy Brewing Company is considered a nano brewery by national standards with a 3-barrel system which produces a Cascadian dark ale with a smoke malt twist, a Berliner Weiss with peach and ginger, and an American pale ale called the Trophy Wife, among others. And they also serve pizza. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.